Well, we're with Professor Brian Sykes. We're talking about genetics, DNA USA, Adam's Curse. Also, he's looking at possibly Yeti, Bigfoot's DNA. Let's check in with him on that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And Brian, I want to get into the incredible information in your original book, Adam's Curse, but I've got to ask you again about this Yeti, Bigfoot work that you're doing here. So what sparked your interest in that, first of all?
Well, 10 years ago, somebody came to me with some so-called Yeti hairs from the little Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan, and they turned out in the end to be from two different sorts of bear. But nonetheless, I thought, well, that's quite interesting. Didn't do anything else about it until I finished, actually the day after I handed a manuscript for DNA USA. I was thinking, oh, that's great. I can have a rest now, because I did, that was an awful lot of work. And then the day after, I suddenly had this nightmare not an unpleasant one, but it said, look, you just got to look up that old Yeti stuff you did and see if you can write a book about that. And that's what started it all. It was terrible, really. I'd much rather put my feet up. Anyway, so I looked into what we'd done. A student of mine from years ago, Helen Chandler, had done this work, and it was a very nice piece of work. And I thought, well, as I was saying to you just before the break, I wonder what all these other Yeti bits and pieces that you hear about from time to time are. And I could see that, you know, there might be a possibility of writing this up as a book. So I spent about a year poking around and seeing what's out there, looking into the background, which actually turns out to be absolutely fascinating. And I've made a collaboration with the University of the Museum of Zoology in Lausanne, which has a fantastic archive from a man they call the father of cryptozoology, a man called Bernard Heuvelmans. His papers extending over 50 years are there, and I've been over there several times to look through. So there's all the ingredients of a really good book, but there's no reason why I should write anything authoritative about Yetis unless I could do some new DNA testing. So using a new protocol, I've been asking people to send me hair samples in particular, and sent out a press release about a month ago, which has a fantastic response, particularly from America. And all sorts of things are winging their way to my lab as we speak.
Well, you may find some incredible things, Brian. When do you think you're going to get some results?
Well, I'll get some results fairly soon, I think. But I'm deliberately not going to look at them until I've got them all in, and then I can sort of follow up the backstories, what these samples are, and then I'll decode them and see what we've got. I mean, one of the reasons which makes this a good time to do it is that it's now clear from recent fossil discoveries that there were, until relatively recently, and I'm talking about 5,000-10,000 years, other human species definitely living on all over the world. There's the Neanderthals, which people know about. There's a new species found in Siberia, the Denisovans. There may be another one from China. There's the small human, the so-called hobbit, in the Indonesian island of Flores. So that there clearly was a time when Homo sapiens was not the only human. And one asks, you know, about extinctions and how did these other things become extinct, these other hominids. And maybe, and one of the explanations for Yetis and Bigfoot and things like that are that they are small relic populations of these other human species. And so that's another reason which makes it topical to investigate the whole phenomenon right now.
How soon, Brian, how soon, when you look at the DNA, would you be able to ascertain if there's something different here? Does that take a while, or is it pretty quick for you?
It's quite fast, really. So let's say, just to be entirely theoretical, and frankly, I doubt whether this will happen, but let's say it did, that somebody sent me a Yeti hair, and I only need one or two hairs, and it was actually a Neanderthal. How long would it take me to find out? Well, about 3 weeks. That's all.
Well, that's not bad at all.
And if it were a hair of a Neanderthal, a surviving Neanderthal, I would know it without any question.
And it would be definitive. You would say beyond a shadow of the. Now, we're assuming that the sample was taken from, you know, an authentic area,
It doesn't. Even that doesn't matter. If it's from a Neanderthal, even if it's wherever it's from,
in a museum somewhere, for all we know.
Yeah, in a museum, then I would be able to recognize it as such.
Oh, that's
amazing.
And
it's the ability to do that. I think I feel protected going into what is, after all, a very controversial area. And
sure.
It's an area that has a long history of hoaxes and frauds and downright lies. But I don't feel the least bit nervous now going into that area because, as far as I know, nobody can fabricate DNA sequence. So, as I just said, if there's a hair from a Neanderthal and I get hold of it and it's in reasonable condition, then I'll be able to recognize it as such without any shadow of a doubt.
If it was from a species totally unknown, and let's say it is from a Yeti, a Bigfoot, would you also know that within a few weeks?
Yes, because I'm targeting pieces of DNA that we know a lot about, and that is we know the sequence of this DNA from pretty well every species that exists that we know about on the planet. So let's suppose that it was from some animal that was halfway between, on an evolutionary scale, between ourselves and, let's say, chimpanzees. Although clearly if it's an unknown animal, there won't be any record of its sequence, but nonetheless, from comparing its sequence to humans, to chimpanzees and other animals, I'd be able to place it at that point on the evolutionary tree, if you like, between the two, even though it had never been seen before.
Is it expensive to do a DNA test, or are you doing this on your own?
It is expensive. It's about $1,500 a go. It's what it cost me to do these.
No,
so, well, some people would think that's expensive, others not so. It depends how much money you've got. So clearly it's something that needs to be funded, and as I do these days, I fund the next research on the proceeds of previous books. Because this kind of work, frankly, it's not really worth even bothering asking for government support or research council support. You wouldn't get it, and I don't think that's any bad thing. This is not the sort of thing that that health charities or anything else is going to fund.
No.
Anyway, that's what I'm doing, and I've had tremendous support, particularly from organizations like Bigfootology in America.
Sure, good people.
Yeah, they are, and one thing that has surprised me is that, you never know when you're going to an area. That's one of the most exciting things about it. I thought, well, you know, nobody's going to send me anything because they're going to be so suspicious or what have you. But actually, people haven't been like that at all. By and large, these have been very authentic samples. They may not turn out to be a new species, but the people who sent them are seriously serious about trying to find out what they are. And that was one of the criteria I set myself before putting a lot of effort into this work. That is to say that the Bigfootologists, the cryptozoologists were seriously trying to find out what was going on rather than sort of carrying on in some sort of haze of harmless delusion, which is all right, but it's not something I want to spend a lot of time investigating.
No, I understand. But now I want to understand, I heard you right. Did you say it would cost $1,500 for the test? $1,500? Yeah, that's it?
What's it? Not a whole lot. That's each one.
No, but, you know, I have, you wait till I tell you this story. We've had a guest on for years who claims that he has a skull of what could be an extraterrestrial. It's elongated. It's a legitimate skull. What it is, I don't know. But it's a legitimate elongated skull with huge eye sockets. And he is convinced that if DNA was done on it, you could be able to determine whether it's extraterrestrial or a hybrid, maybe a combination of the both. Would you be able to check that if my network paid for that test?
That's not a hair, then that's a skull, is it?
It's a skull. It's bone.
Has it got teeth?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. If it does that make it easier?
It does. I prefer working with teeth. I can work with bone, but teeth are better. And the reason is that inside the tooth, you drill into the tooth, inside the tooth, there's very little risk of contamination. One of the big problems with all this kind of work is that it's contaminated by the people who have handled it. So if you're not very careful, all you'll do is recover your own DNA or those of the archaeologist or the curator. So that's why teeth are fine, as long as they're in reasonable condition. Yeah.
So when you have time, Google Star Child Project.
Okay.
And see if that's something that you think you might do, and I'll get the network to pay for the test, and we'll get that to you. I would love. Now we got to convince Lloyd Pye, who's holding this thing, to do this. But I would love to get your results. I mean, you may come. I mean, there's no question in the past, civilizations, because of their culture, elongated skulls. They had a way of doing it,
and they did. Right. Yeah. And some people have those just as a kind of genetic mutation. You get all kinds of.
That's right. So let's check on it.
I don't know that I'm. I mean, here I wouldn't say I would commit to extending my search to aliens. But nonetheless, if it's got DNA, then I'm happy to consider it.
Okay, that would be exciting. I'll do some checking, and you Google Star Child Project. I'll make sure one of my staff members gets you that link, and we'll see. We'll just take a look. Now, you wrote a fascinating book years ago called Adam's Curse, where you came across a shocking claim, and it's interesting that you did then, 8-9 years ago, that human males are in the process of going extinct, and now we're hearing from scientists that there's no question that the birth rate of males seems to be dropping and the ability to reproduce is slowing down. Something's happening. What did you find when you did the book Adam's Curse?
Yeah. Well, Adam's Curse is about the male equivalent of mitochondria. That's what we've been talking about, maternally inherited DNA. And it's about a little chromosome called the Y chromosome. And men have got it, women haven't got it. And if you've got a Y chromosome and it works properly, then and you're an embryo, you'll develop into a boy. If you don't have Y chromosome or it's not working properly, then you'll develop into a girl. So really, it's no exaggeration to say that that men are genetically modified women. If nothing happens on the Y chromosome or the important gene is missing, the natural course of development is into a girl. Now, it happens that the Y chromosome itself, when it's sequenced, you can see it's a graveyard of genes. There are very few that are still working. It was originally part of the X chromosome, which women have two copies, men have one, and which is a perfectly normal chromosome packed full of genes. The Y chromosome, most of those genes have mutated and degenerated, leaving only a very few that are working. They're not unimportant genes, and some of them control male fertility. That also happens that unlike all the other chromosomes that we have, the Y chromosome is unable to interact with its partner. Most of our chromosomes come in pairs, other than the Y, and they exchange information, and that keeps them healthy. But the Y chromosome can't do that. So it's sort of very lonely. It never sees another Y chromosome. and the result of that, it can't repair damage done by mutations. Also, it's the only piece of DNA that spends its entire life in what is really the hotbed of mutation, which is the male germline, where the cells that eventually produce sperm are dividing very fast. So if you're a 60-year-old man, the sperm that you produce, the DNA in that has already, the sperm cells are already the result of 1,000 cell divisions within your own body.
Right.
So, and that's when mutations usually happen. So there are very high rates of mutation in the male germline. So as a result of all of those things, mutations are accumulating in the Y chromosome and destroyed most of the genes already. And in many cases of male infertility, you can see these new mutations have knocked out genes important for fertility. And that's one of the reasons, not the only one, that male fertility rates are dropping. And it's on that basis that I'm predicted that they will continue to drop as the Y chromosome becomes less and less healthy in time, and eventually all males will be infertile and will disappear. Now, not everyone agrees with that, and it was only a prediction based on a number of assumptions which I put into Adam's Curse. But as you say, there have been subsequent investigations to support the idea that male fertility is increasing.
And once that happens, are we history as a species?
Well, I think that what sets us apart from other species, to which this has already happened, many species, I think, have gone extinct for this very reason.
Mm-hmm.
That the Y chromosome has sort of petered out. In one particular rodent, very interestingly, the important gene that makes you male has migrated from the Y chromosome to another one of the chromosomes. And the Y chromosome in that little rodent, it's called the mole vole, has actually has disappeared. But because the gene, the important gene, had jumped ship beforehand and landed on another chromosome, the species was saved. But I think that if it doesn't happen in the natural way in other species, then those species become extinct. In our own case, we know about it, so we can artificially transfer the important genes to other chromosomes or do one of a number of things to make sure that the Y chromosome survived. That is, if we wanted it to.
I tell you what, we're coming up to a break anyway, so I'll come back with you in just a moment, Professor Brian Sykes with us, talking about one of his first works, Adam's Curse, A Future Without Men. I mean, what happens when it all stops? How can you save that Y chromosome? We'll be back. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Professor Brian Sykes as we talk about DNA, genetics, the Bigfoot samples, you name it. But we'll be back in a moment. We'll continue talking with him about what's happening to the male Y chromosome. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Brian, this Y chromosome, why is it genetically falling apart? What's happening to it?
Sorry, George, I'm just eating an apple.
a GMO apple, nonetheless, right?
No doubt. Yeah.
This Y chromosome. What is happening to it? Why is it falling apart?
Well, it's just very lonely. It can't interact with any other chromosomes. That's part of the way that chromosomes resist decay due to mutation, but the Y chromosome can't do it. So it has a very high mutation rate, and there's nothing it can do about it. So as time goes on, the Y chromosomes are becoming thicker, and that's leading to an increase, in some cases, of male infertility. It's in a nutshell, really.
Did you see this first in, let's say, frogs or other kinds of species?
Well, it's... it's all to do with the way all animals, or really the majority of animals, divided into males and females, but they don't all use Y chromosomes to decide what the sex of an embryo is going to be. Sometimes it's the temperature of their incubation, as in crocodiles, alligators, turtles. Sometimes it's the environment. So some fish, for example, can change from female to male. There's only one male in the group, and when that one dies or is taken away, one of the females takes over the male role. So there's numerous ways in which sex is determined. But all mammals have evolved to have sex determined by chromosomes. And so they're the ones that are vulnerable to extinction when the Y chromosome, over a very long period of time, degenerates.
Now, in order to save humanity, if this continues at the rate, the alarming rate that it's occurring, what can you do to reverse that, if anything?
Well, one thing that's possible to do is to take this gene, the gene that determines maleness, and take it off the Y chromosome and put it somewhere else. But, you know, I think what's going to happen is that at some point in the future, you'll get, and I think it's now been done in mice, and there's no real reason why it shouldn't be done in humans. There's a few things to get right first. But it's possible now to fertilize an egg, not with a sperm, but with the DNA from another egg. And so you can get, that raises the possibility, and as I say, it's been done in mice, of having children born from not a man and a woman, but from the genetic elements from an egg of two women. I'm surprised it hasn't been done already in a way, because there's lots of same-sex women couples, lesbian couples, who have children. They always have to involve a man in this process. But there's no real reason why that should be necessary. So looking way ahead, it may well be that a new human species, which doesn't have males at all, evolves. There we are. We've got another hominid species on the planet. But this is the realms of fantasy. It's one of the things that I speculate about in Adam's Curse. But that doesn't mean it's going to happen.
But it could.
Well, it could, yeah.
When you looked at the profile cases of Iceman, tell me about that. And what was he, 5,000 years old, if I recall?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that came to my attention anyway, quite soon after I worked out how to get DNA from ancient fossils. Now, the Iceman was found at the top of a glacier on the border between Italy and Austria, high up in the mountains. And it's very unusual to find a body that's quite so old in a glacier, simply because glaciers over time flow downhill, and say after about 500 years, anything put in the top of a glacier has fallen out of the bottom. So it was widely thought that this must be a hoax. Somebody helicoptered the DNA, helicoptered the body in and buried it in the ice.
Buried it in the ice, yeah.
Yeah. And they think, well, why would anyone want to do that? But there's plenty of other examples of elaborate hoaxes being played in the area of human evolution. So one of the reasons that it was worth looking at the DNA is to decide whether this was genuinely a European body, or had it been a hoax, it would probably have come from South America, because there's a lot of mummies in the high plains of South America, thousands of them, and it probably would have come from there. But it turned out that the Iceman was indeed, from the DNA test, a European. And that then put an end to the story that it would have been a hoax, because it certainly couldn't have come from anywhere else like South America. So that was scientific importance. But to me, one of the funny things was, and it really was important in the future direction of my own research, is that a newspaper rang up and said, well, how do you know that this body was European? I said, well, it matches other Europeans from volunteers that I've had. And they said, well, who? And that was the first time I'd ever really thought about the samples of the volunteers as being very much more than just labelled tubes in the freezer. Of course, I knew they'd come from people, but it didn't really matter who they were to me, just the DNA sequence. So after the report had rung off, I said, well, can't tell you anyway, because it's all confidential. I did find that one of the people whose genetic profile matched that of the Iceman was a friend of mine. And I asked her, she's a very articulate Irish lady, and she said she didn't mind being identified to the newspaper, so I told them who it was. And the story came out, the story then came out in Britain first and then around the world, and the element of the story that interested most people was not so much the scientific side of it, but how she thought, this friend of mine, now she found out that she was a relative of the Iceman from 5,000 years ago. And she was a relative of the Iceman, there's no doubt about it. And she began to think, well, I'm not so sure I like the way he's being treated. You know, he's been shown lying on the mortuary slab, frozen, bits and pieces have been cut off him and everything. And she began to think of it like anyone would, about sort of an uncle or something like that. And so that's really what got me very interested in the individual reaction to ancestries, which has guided my work ever since.
Interesting. Fascinating, too. Well, now with the work with DNA, can you, if you were to test everybody, do we all go back to that single source, Brian?
Yes, to Africa.
Okay.
And about 200,000 years ago. But as I said a little while ago on the program, or perhaps I didn't. No, I can't. No, we know that there were other, and I didn't say it, there were other humans alive while our own species has been on the Earth, Homo sapiens. So in the last 200,000 years, we now know there were other human species. And we further know in work that's been published only in the last couple of years that our ancestors and these other species did interbreed to a small extent. So, for example, in Europeans and Asians, somewhere between 2% and 4% of our DNA is actually of Neanderthal origin.
Interesting.
And this is a huge surprise.
Oh, yeah. It is. That's a great story.
It is. And that's one of the things I'm looking at in this YETI project as well, seeing if there are regions of the world where the level of hybridization is even higher, which you might expect had Neanderthals survived into the much more recent past than, say, in southern Europe, which is they died out about 30,000 years ago. That's one of the angles. So so we did all come from the bulk of our ancestry, the bulk of our DNA did come from East Africa something like 200,000 years ago, but we clearly have the ancestors of some of us in Europe, for example, in Asia, have interbred with Neanderthals. And I mentioned another species that was found in Siberia, quite an astonishing piece of work, a new human species called the Denisovans, recognized from just one fragment of a finger, found in a cave, the Denisova cave in southern Siberia, and shown just by DNA to be so different either from Neanderthals or from modern humans that it must be a new species. And then when the similar comparison was made to see what has anyone in other parts of the world been interbreeding with the Denisovans or the ancestors of Denisovans, an amazing result, which still hasn't fully been explained, that in Melanesia, Papua New Guinea, for example, in other parts of Indonesia, but in Melanesia, in Papua New Guinea the most, 7% of their DNA has originated in the Denisovans.
Can you, just by looking at DNA, project what they might have looked like?
Not yet, no. It will be possible. There's if you have a very good DNA sequence, you might be able to, for example, work out what color hair they might have had and skin and so forth. But our knowledge of which genes it is that are involved in appearance is still something of a mystery. So no, it's a good question, but no is the answer.
That's all fascinating work. Brian, this area that you have gone into, are there many scientists doing what you do?
Oh yeah. Well, in general there are, but I don't think there's many that are actually spending any time looking at Bigfoot
No,
and
no. But that'll get you the publicity.
Yetis. Well, it certainly
Strangely.
is proving to be very popular. I suppose what I've done in recent years is to direct my research, for example, for DNA USA, into a form that is suitably published as a book. So although all the data is there for people to look at as in a scientific sense, it's not written up as a scientific publication in the normal academic way. I mean, I still do those from time to time, but I'm more interested now in producing original research which ends up as a book which, like DNA USA, is written so that people don't have to be experts in genetics or anything like that to get something from it. I enjoy doing, I really do, because I can get my teeth into a project. I can cover all sorts of areas, the history, the archaeology, all these kinds of things in a book, which I really can't do if I was restricting myself just to doing an ordinary piece of academic work, which would end up in a peer-reviewed publication.
The kind of computer software that you use, programming, to help you do what you do, who develops that? Do you have to develop your own, or are there other companies that do that?
Well, it's not. Well, for example, the software that's used to draw these conclusions from the DNA sequence. There's plenty of software involved in actually getting the DNA sequence, but that's big business. The sequencing machines are far too expensive for individual labs to have. So those are all run. Have enormously high throughput machinery in special centres, which is one of which I use in Oxford. And there's lots of software required to run those machines, to interpret them. And then I use other kinds of software, for example, to compare a DNA sequence and to see where it lies in the evolutionary tree. Or there's other software, for example, when trying to calculate or estimate which chromosome have come from Africa, Europe, or Native America, which is what's behind the most of the original work in DNA USA. Yeah, so all kinds of things. It wouldn't be any good asking me to develop software because I couldn't do it.
No. Okay. Now, you've also looked at the legacy of Genghis Khan. How did that happen?
Yes, well, this is an amazing story, really. It's not work that I did myself, although I have, as you'll hear, I did a little bit following on. Some colleagues of mine in Oxford and other universities found a particular Y chromosome defined by a detailed fingerprint, very widespread across Asia. Now, it's unusual, very unusual, to find exactly the same Y chromosome fingerprint in males from a very wide area. They tend to be far more localized. And the explanation that my colleagues came up with was that this Y chromosome has been spread by a single from a single male. And the geographical limits of the distribution were exactly those of the Mongol Empire, which was started by Genghis Khan back in the 12th century. There are other pieces of circumstantial evidence. For example, a tribe in northwest Pakistan had a long history, an oral history of having been descended from Genghis Khan, and that Y chromosome was in high abundance in that tribe, but absent from surrounding tribes. And there were other pieces of circumstantial evidence, without finding his body, which has never been found, that suggested that that Y chromosome that is so abundant and so widespread in Asia, and there are about 16 million men that carry it now, are all ultimately descended from Genghis Khan. And you can see that how that might have happened, because his military strategy when he invaded an area was to kill all the men and mate with all the women, or as many as he could manage. Even his doctor said he should have a day off from time to time. And he did that. He passed his wealth and probably his habits to his sons, and then through the Mongol dynasties that build up, through their sons and so on. So it was continued, and the result of this escalation, the chain reaction really, is that there are now 16 million men who have Genghis Khan's Y chromosome. They are his descendants. And I did find one in America in an accountant in Florida too. Just he was one of the people that I looked at for other reasons. Huh. And he too was descended from Genghis Khan. At least I think he was.
You know where people will make fun of somebody? They may say, well, you're like your parents. It's genetics. Whatever they did, whether they were crooks or good people, it's genetics. Do genetics play a part in people's personalities?
Yes. To the best example of that, really, is not in humans, but in dogs, for example. Different breeds of dogs which have been selectively bred have vastly different personalities. And it's entirely down to the genetics, what they've inherited. And the same is true of humans. Huge differences. We don't know what these genes are, but there are enormous personality differences that can be inherited through DNA. So the answer is most definitely yes.
Brian, when we come back, we're going to take phone calls with you, but I also want to talk with you about genetics and memory, to see if in cells, for example, memory is carried on. If somebody, for example, gets a transplant of some site from someone, will they inherit their memory? We'll be back.